Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 14th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Violence Today, presented by Bob Hawk. The number is HABOB2006-05. Let's listen in.
Have to take seriously the Old Testament. Second day, context. We looked at the book of Amos, who has oracles against the nations, and tried to see the context there and how you see that. Through what lens you see that makes a difference in how it goes. Third day, we looked at Zephaniah. And I tried to set him within a political context, which I'm not going to try and repeat in 4 seconds. It's too complicated. Maybe that's part of what the third day was, is things are complicated. Sort of context and politics all mixed together. Two things I want to talk about that we haven't talked about, both of which have come either vertently or inadvertently. Is vertently a word? You guys know?
It should be
if it isn't. So I was browsing the bookshelf this morning in the Lutheran for July 2006, which Paul Olson provided for our house up there. And one of the main articles, Religion in the Public Square, Religion and Politics. If you don't think that's an issue, believe the Lutheran. I mean, if you can't believe anything else, you can believe that. So you might want to take a look at what the Lutheran has to say about it. I didn't study the article carefully, but the question is there. That's the more important thing. And the other important thing, how many of you are going to be here this coming week yet? Some of you. Those of you who are, I think there's going to be a forum or something on Barack Obama's speech.
Okay.
Is that right? I think there should be a forum on Barack Obama's speech where he talks about his understanding of the relationship between religion and politics and does it in a not stupid way. that's pretty high praise. Yeah, that's pretty high praise. I think there will be a... Well, even if there's not a forum, those of you who are here, insist on a forum. And I bet you get an ally in Paul Olson.
And how would we get a copy of that if we need it?
Ask Paul Olson. I don't know.
He's not here today, so yeah. I would get some of those done, run off.
Yeah, I think it would be a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a really good speech.
Yeah, there it is, Bob. It'll be in the library, and you can go there and read it.
Okay. And in fact, I'm going to give, so I don't walk away with this inadvertently, I'm going to give this back to him. I could walk away with it inadvertently, but I won't. Yesterday, some of you were here yesterday. We haven't finished yesterday yet. We have to finish it. But what do you think was the point of yesterday? Okay, so how do we interpret violence theologically? And we came up to one answer, yeah?
No.
Okay, good.
Trick question.
All right, so what I was trying to do, and what we'll try and finish out doing here, is to say, when we think about violence, at least when I started just thinking about it, I thought, well, there's a simple answer. Christians are against violence, right? That's the end. And what I've come to understand is it's way, way, way more complex than that. And maybe if you got lost in the complexity yesterday of the issues, that's a good thing probably, because that then shows us something. It's not just a simple, it's just not a simple topic. So which violence, what violence are you talking about? What's the context? What explanation is given by the people who are experiencing it? So the complexity of the violence. Now we had up there violence when we win, violence when it's threatened, and violence when we lose. And we got through, when we lose and experience violence and we deserve it, God punishes us. That's divine justice. What's Ellie Beach's name for that divine justice thing? The retribution box that she talks about. It's the theology that we all grow up with as 2-year-olds. If we do good, we get blessed. If we do bad, we get punished. Hopefully, I tried to make the case, there's a potential. potential upside to that. Once you're punished, then what can happen? There can be a restoration, and there can be hope. We don't deserve it. These are the ones we talked about. God could be testing us. Lots of us, I think, have that interpretation of violence when it happens to us. This is a trial sent by God. That's a main interpretation of what book of the Bible? Job. And do you remember what I said about that? Don't interpret Job that way. It says in the book of Job that God does it for no reason. So therefore, he can't be testing. If he was testing, that would be a reason, yeah? So we'll get to Job a little bit later. So I think, can other people, can you think of a context where you maybe have even played into this? Where examples where that testing thing comes out? On some level, sometimes it's a helpful thing to think, oh, God's just testing me. Any examples or Bible passages that jump to mind? Some of you guys know New Testament way better than me. Isn't there a New Testament passage that says God will never give you something
more than
you are able? I mean, have you ever heard that passage said? And usually that's said by someone who's not exactly experiencing the trouble.
Yeah.
Because when you're experiencing real trouble, it doesn't seem like, oh, well, yeah, this I can handle this. God's going to help me. So that passage, sometimes that passage helps. And you say, yeah, he'll give me the resources to handle this. It's just a test, though. And so it's not so scary. So sometimes that works. And if we pass the test, when we pass the test, then we can be restored. Talked about God allows the trouble, not causes it, but allows it. We get killed or hurt, and what happens? We become martyrs, and for that we get a reward, which in our tradition often is something like heaven. Just to remind you, the idea of heaven is a fairly late idea. That option right there wouldn't have been available to people before about 300 or 400 BC. Back in the old days, they didn't have ideas of an afterlife like we have today. Those come from outside. They come from outside and for reasons we won't go into today. So there's a few other ones that I had in my list, but can you think of others? Other ways that we don't deserve the violence that happens to us? Other explanations?
It's all part of a bigger plan.
Oh. Man, that's good. I didn't have that one.
My wife gets that in the hospital chaplain. So.
God has big plan. The theology behind that is pretty simple, right? God is big and powerful. What's the anthropology behind that answer? Yeah, and not just little, but kind of stupid. Yeah, it's such a big plan that we can't figure it out, and so we just kind of trust God that God will take it.
God's will.
And God's will. We are. Can somebody think of a biblical place where that explanation gets played out?
Old Testament Joseph.
Yeah, and Joseph gets sold into slavery, gets all kinds of problems along the way, and yet his life seems to be headed toward saving his family's life and other people's lives. And Joseph goes along not knowing what the plan is, but kind of trusting it. Yeah, I think that's good. Joseph would be a good example. Joseph is an interesting case, especially, I think he's the only kind of major character in the Bible, I guess we'll say except Jesus, there's never any sin, he never does anything wrong. Have you ever noticed that? You can't think of a story where Joseph screwed things up somehow. He always gets it right.
don't know, there's a certain amount of hubris at the beginning of that
story. Yeah, there could be.
Yeah, he's proud.
Yeah, look at my cool coat, and Dad loves me best.
Your
sheaves are going to be about me. But, I mean, that's just, he's just reporting the facts, I mean. Maybe it's in tone. That's what my wife always says. It's hard to argue with tone. I think that's certainly one. I got to add that to my list at some point. I have another one.
But what about if you die? You're tested, you die.
I think that's just kind of a radical version of the testing one.
Yeah, but what if I'm looking at the third one now.
Oh.
No, up one.
There.
To become a martyr, somebody has to pay attention. Has to notice and find meaning in your death.
Okay.
What if you just die and nobody cares and nobody pays attention? And
so, so then we lose and we don't deserve it. And
nothing good comes of it.
And nothing good comes of it. Interesting. If we want to have...
There you go.
No. This is exactly, I think, one that we don't talk about that we should be talking about. Now, if we assume that God is in control, let's keep that assumption for the moment, then what must be true? He either doesn't care, okay.
Or he's not paying attention.
Or let's say that this is God. I'm going to have another category here. But if God's doing it, actually, it could be worse than that. If God kills me for no reason,
God hates me.
Or he screws it up somehow. Yeah. God makes a mistake. God makes a mistake. And what would we say then? If we don't deserve it and he punishes us, what's happened? Then he's not just anymore. We come back to the justice issue. Then what?
Capricious.
They're capricious or unjust. Yeah. Either one. Is that, you wouldn't think that viewpoint would be in the Bible at all, is it? Anybody think about a biblical place that view is there?
Only God, not Jesus, right? I mean, to me, I have trouble with Syrophoenician woman. To me, that's a big mistake.
Okay. He's pretty harsh with her, isn't he? Yeah, he's pretty harsh with her. I don't know how to respond to only God, not Jesus. No matter how I answer that, I'm in trouble. Okay.
You know, it bothers me, those last two things, that it diminishes the person as if the person is important, that the person is just a
cog in the wheel, sort of.
Part time with.
We like to think of ourselves as more than mere cogs, especially as Western and especially as Americans. We have resources and we can take independent action. I'm reading a book here about a guy who does medical stuff in Haiti. Do those Haitians have much power over their own lives? It would be easy to think of them as, or if, it would be easy for them to think of themselves, and maybe they are just cogs in a bigger machine that just grinds them out.
But it really runs against my feeling of a, I don't want to overstate this, but some sort of a, not, I hate to use the word personal relationship, but as from my position, having a relationship with God, and then to have it come back that I'm nothing, it hurts me. I don't know how to say it.
And this wouldn't mean that every one of the, certainly not all of these ways of dealing with violence will fit everyone. And what I think is true probably is that all of us probably pick different of these in different cases. Yeah. Can anybody think there's an important book here. Katie doesn't have the answer, so she's.
Answer
but right. There's an important scriptural example of this.
I think the flood is a good example.
Yeah.
God, I mean, at the end, he says, "I will never do this again."
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? You know, and not only that, you know, it's a great story, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
God says, "I'm gonna always wipe them all out, damn them." and then he says, and you can almost hear somebody saying, "Well, what about Noah?" And God says, "All right." And then Noah saying, "The wife, you know? And she says, what about the boys? And they said, wives? And pretty soon you got a whole ark full of people. And at the, if you think about that, it almost looks like the author is saying, what happened? God just sort of decreed something in a fit of passion, and then he kind of backs off of it. Not out of kind of principle, but kind of like saying, all right, I screwed up. Now, that's fine if you happen to be Noah and the wife and the kids. But if you happen to be one of the other, you know, 7 billion people on the earth, whatever there was, it's probably a little rough. Can you think of another? There's another example.
But God doesn't make mistakes.
Interesting question, isn't it?
God changes God's mind.
But God changes God's mind. Mm-hmm.
He's all knowing. He's everything.
Yeah.
I don't understand how he can say that.
This would be an interesting session, set of sessions. Does God make mistakes?
Well, I think so.
Okay.
Okay.
So now we've got an argument. That's perfect.
Well, but that's, you know, me not knowing the mystery and all of that. What that's saying is about your 10-year-old nephew.
Yeah. So you're saying
our first grandson. So to me, it's like there's no way I will ever see any plan.
Okay. There's another answer to that. So, there's another way off that hook.
Yeah.
But that's sort of saying God never makes mistakes, so everything that happens is part of the big plan.
It's part of the big plan.
Yeah.
No, somehow.
I can take that up. We don't
get it.
Sorry.
People die in our lives. We don't get it. Right. We don't understand why.
I can understand. Let me just, we could go for hours on that one. But let me give you what, for me, is the clincher, the really hard case. I can understand that in a lot of cases. Maybe even my 10-year-old nephew. Maybe there was some good that came out of that that was worth it. I don't really believe that, but maybe there is. But what do you do with 6 million Jews?
Yeah.
What do you do with this 6 million homosexuals?
That's not God's mistake. That's the devil.
Okay. So you're not really a monotheist then?
Yes, not.
but where is this issue fought out? This is exactly the issue.
Okay. But can't you, I mean, and maybe this isn't as biblical of an idea, but that we have free will, and so the promise of God being with us always is God is present in our lives and with us, but that God is not letting certain things happen and then stopping other things from happening.
Okay.
And so we are.
All right. Let me make, I want to finish this one because we're leaking that into my next category perfectly here. God makes a mistake. Who says that? That is what Job says. That's what the book of Job says. Job says, God, you screwed up. I'm innocent. You punished me without reason. And is Job correct?
Yes.
He is. So Job says, God made a mistake. So.
But only if you operate in that box.
Yeah, we could argue about whether Job got it right or not.
But what about the fallen world? And am I missing it?
In the book of Job.
No, not Job. The whole thing there.
All of
be known, I guess. I'm looking for the you know, sin in the world and the fallen nature. But would it be?
This is another way off the hook is to say. Original sin. Lutherans are good on that. Yeah? There is no B. Yeah? I mean, isn't that what original sin is trying to say? There is no B. The only problem you've got, first of all, it's hard. That doctrine isn't in the Bible. That's the first problem with it. You can kind of tease it out. But then you have problems with certain stories. Now, you can just say Job is just a story. But in the story of Job, it says, God's self says, He is perfect. The word in there, Job is perfect, means perfect. And God himself says it over and over again about Job. That's his brag about Job, actually. So God, at least in the story of the book of Job, doesn't believe in original sin. He doesn't believe that Job deserves it. If there's original sin and we all are failed, if Paul is right about that, then this category just goes away. We all deserve whatever happens to us. You should, not maybe today, but at some point in your life, argue with that a little bit. you may still come to the conclusion that that's the right answer, but argue with it. It's not the, there are lots of other biblical answers. That's not the only one, and you won't find a text in the Bible that I know of anyway that says everybody's going to fry because Eve ate the apple. It isn't there. And that's a development. We can thank Augustine for that. He did a lot of good things, but maybe one thing not so good. But now we were getting down into the other category here. This says all of these other things that we had up here where God's in control and somehow it's there's an answer to it. This one gets into a problem. It says God's in control, but sometimes he might screw up. Some people believe that, maybe. Other people don't. I don't know what to call this one. I just, on my chart here, I call it... It's not that we don't deserve it or don't deserve it. It's just that we're unlucky somehow. Something bad happens to us. And God's not involved with it. Okay? Now that's interesting. There's two possibilities there, I think. What would be if God's not in control? There would be two ways of that happening, I think. Okay, it could be another power in control. So God is not what we all think of as God is all powerful, right? But maybe he's not all powerful. And in fact, again, this is a long, big conversation, but somebody said something about free will. Was that Cana? Yeah. If we have free will, is God, do you believe that? That we have free will? You can make actual choices. Some of you are saying, yeah.
So you can.
So now, but if you think about it, if we have free will, what does that mean? I can do what? I can tell God.
Buzz off.
Or worse. Yeah, I can tell God go away. Which means what, isn't he?
Not in control.
He's not in control. Mm-hmm. I might do something that he doesn't want me to do. Wow, that's interesting. Therefore, he's not all powerful. Now, if that's the case, then when there's something bad, one way to explain it is to say, it's us killing each other, or me killing myself, or stuff just happens. God's not in control of everything. So that's an interesting possibility.
There's even a movement in evangelical community, isn't there? I can't remember the name of it, but Bethel Clark Pinnock and some Pentecostals argue C2 that God isn't necessarily in control. God limits God's own sovereignty in order to have free will.
We could get into a philosophical argument there. If God limits his own control, then he's controlling his control, and he could decide not to limit his control. So he's in what control? So it gets slippery. What that argument tends to do is just push the thing back to some earlier stage. This is a more radical statement saying maybe God's not in control. There's a hand back.
I was going to say on that point, a simple concrete thing would be a covenant, right? God is in control, but God has made a covenant with the Israelites and with Abraham, and therefore he has limited his
okay.
To be with these people. That's an example of God.
Yeah.
And so he can't break that.
Except when he does.
People go back and say from God, don't forget the covenant. And there's literary ways around that.
Except it's kind of interesting. I'm going to try and complexify things a little bit. So the covenant with Abraham says the Jews are the chosen people, right?
Not precisely, but Abraham's offspring, I guess.
Okay. And you're related to him how? No, well, but Christians come along and say,
I thought you were talking about the Holocaust.
Well, okay, yeah, that would be, but no, what I'm saying is Christians come along and they say, oh, he had that old covenant with them, but now he has this new covenant with us, which means what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what happens? And this, I mean, you don't, well, I don't know. There are promises in that covenant that says a king will rule in Jerusalem forever. It's in the Bible.
But in order to have a covenant, it's like a contract, which is undeserved, and God makes his promises, but don't you also have to accept him, don't you? I mean, there are consequences in your actions as to whether you accept the...
Depends on if it's conditional or unconditional, in a contract even, yeah? Mm-hmm. If it's an unconditional contract, the person has to do it no matter what the receiver has in it. Okay. And in the Bible, there are both conditional and unconditional contracts. I understand your point. I'm just trying to muddy the waters a little bit. So,
yeah.
So, but that's just, isn't that just a version of God limiting his own power?
I think so, but I just didn't like the... I just wanted to be concrete about an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
I would be with you always, as Jesus says in Matthew 28, our themes is a similar kind of... It's not a covenant, but it's a promise that I don't want to hear anyone in the room telling me that that's good, not good true anymore,
okay,
for some reason.
But
okay,
can someone be with you but not controlling you?
Yes.
See, that's, I kind
okay
of think.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, now Kate was next.
Well, yeah, I mean, sort of to go off that, I mean, I think that there's a difference between God not being in control in the sense that God doesn't have as much power as we've always thought that God has versus, you know, God's flying a plane and we're in the co-pilot seat and God's like, well, you're flying now and like handing over the control, but like as the Old Testament stories sort of teach us, like at any moment if God wanted to, God could take back the control and send a flood, or you know that control
right
is possible, that God
but
still has the ability to intervene but chooses to give us free will, you know, that
so he lets us fly the plane into the mountainside.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Then I might, and even if we're innocent, we're just...
Well, that's kind of stupid. Free will, that God giving over control to human beings. Yeah.
Don't
we do that as parents?
That's
what
right
we're saying.
No, well, we do to up to a point, but if I see my kid walking in front of a car...
Yeah, but always...
But God can always pull us out, yeah? I mean,
yeah,
that's in theory.
There are gradations of control, aren't there?
I think we're stuck in the whole word control. You're going to have to get beyond that, those
yeah
categories.
Yeah, maybe. It's an important idea, though. Many people think of God as being totally in control of everything that happens. And what I'm saying is, if you go that way, you may not like where you end up. So either maybe we need to get rid of the category altogether, or we have to make that more ambiguous.
I think we have to leave the category there, because that's the way many people think.
Yeah.
You've got to deal with that as a category of theology. That's the way a lot of theology has gone.
And it's one that we deal with. How many people, if you're a pastor or you deal with people that are in tragic situations, sometimes this is the thing that kills faith in them. They say, if God is in control, which is what they believe, then why did he let this happen? And they can't get beyond that. That happened. There is another possibility here, is that he's not in control yet, but he needs a wake-up call from us. We find this in the Psalms a lot, you know, where the psalmist says, hey, are you sleeping up there? I'm hurting down here. Wake up. And then the expectation is he'll come in and fix things. That we can kind of temporarily be in the control of an evil power of some sort, but God will eventually take care of that. So I don't know. Are there other? This is about. I'm about at the end of my list, I think. Are there other kind of things about violence? Other ways of dealing with it, whether you agree with them or not, that you've come up with?
I don't know that it's a whole different category way off the board, but we've got to deal with the fact that that God suffers with humankind. That's part of God's nature to suffer with humankind. Whether you talk about the servant, suffering servant passages in Isaiah or Hosea, taking us constantly back.
Or the whole incarnation theology.
Or the whole incarnation theology, exactly.
Now that's, yeah. See, that flips this whole thing on its head in a way, doesn't it? Because this is all looking at it from whose point of view, from what point of view? From our point of view. And what you're doing is turning it over and saying, so God suffers with us. We might even argue about what the preposition is here. Some people would say for us, but I like with us better. That changes things then, doesn't it? That's an interesting switch in the paradigm. All right, let's. It sounds like we're about frittered out on this. It's as complexified as I can get it today. What I'm going to try and do is now let's talk about the so what. And I don't know. I don't have an answer for this so what part. I've got a couple of things I think that are important in my own thinking. But so what do we do with violence in terms of being Christians? We for it or against it? I don't know how to start it. I'll start it that way. I mean, I was talking to Paul about this, maybe it was even in class the other day, and he said, well, Christians are against violence. Would you all agree with that?
Look at history.
Well, I mean, your gut reaction would say what? Yeah. That's who we want to be. We want to be against violence, and we are against violence. And then we talked for a while, and it got more complicated. And that's, I guess, what I hope to happen in the next 27 minutes is, especially at a place like Holden, we all want to be politically correct and say, well, Christians are against violence, and that's good. But I want to complexify it.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, in terms of starting with the Old Testament matters thing, I just wonder how do we explain if we're dealing with a God that now we don't think is in control in that same way. When we go back to stories of the flood or God bringing the Red Sea down on Pharaoh's army, these stories where it seems like God does intervene, is in control of chosen people, then I just... like, those stories obviously matter to me and have been told them, but then when you're talking to somebody who's not Christian says, well, then why didn't God intervene during the Holocaust or whatever? I mean, just how do you... Because in the Old Testament, it does seem like we're dealing with a God that's in control in that sort of intervening way, at least in some stories. And so if it's the same God in the New Testament and now, then how do you make sense of... I mean, that's like...
Yeah, that's an issue. Let me try something and see if it helps or makes things worse. The story of God drowning the Egyptians in the Red Sea, or even better, in the plagues, the killing of the firstborn.
Yeah,
there's a good one. Yeah. When you think of God being violent, that's an interesting thing. I can remember to this day. The Sunday school bulletin that we used to get when we were kids. And how did you pick? Did you all get this, or do you have one in your mind? How do you picture that play? What do you see?
Babies.
Yeah, dead babies. Yeah. If you think about it rationally, is that what the death of the firstborn would be? It wouldn't be the babies, would it?
Not necessarily.
No, it would be mostly the older kids.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
it'd be all ages, but it wouldn't be the little ones. It would be the oldest ones.
Yeah.
So, but why? When I think back on that, I wonder why did the person who gave me that Sunday school bulletin put dead babies on there?
Impact.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, I hate to say this, but it was a pretty good way of controlling little kids. Yeah. If you're bad, what happens to you? I really believe that. I think that was a way of controlling us as little kids.
Is there any chance that the idea is actually that the phrasing may be different than we've
might recognize it today, that...
No, I hate to tell you, but I mean, it really means he killed the firstborn's children,
but
sons.
But would you think, though, that then the logic goes, because with babies, newborns, they are, in our minds, total innocents. As opposed to a 12-year-old.
That makes it even worse.
As opposed to a 12-year-old who, you know, can be a...
But
there could have been babies, too. I mean, some people's firstborn was their...
Yeah, but let me try this on for size. What if that does it make a difference? It's just a question. Does it make a difference if I tell you that really happened? God came down and we could take a videotape of those dead babies laying there. Or if I said to you, that's a story, and the point of that story wasn't about killing babies of Egyptians. It was about something, forget, it doesn't matter. It's about something else. And that's not, and the point of it is that we should go out and kill Egyptian babies. Now, the question I have is, does that make a difference if I could convince you of B rather than A?
Yes, big time.
See, to me, it makes a huge difference, because then the violence goes from being actual carried out violence to maybe threat of violence, which is, I think, is a different thing. And those two things are somewhat different. I gave some examples in class yesterday about, you know, if I hit my wife, I think it's different than if I threatened to hit her. It might not be good, either one of them good. We can argue about that, but I think there's a difference, all right? I believe there's a difference. I could do a class on the Exodus story sometime. It's a great story, yeah.
It's just that there are implications, of course, for deciding that some of those episodes are literary. For example, now Moses becomes possibly a literary figure,
okay.
A created figure.
Right.
And it's hard, where do we stop with saying, well, this is a story? So,
this is, of course, the
burden that many people have, is as they look at these texts as texts, and they begin to say, well, now where do we stop?
And do you remember where I...
It's easy to buy that argument, but then you have to walk around.
You have to keep doing it, and you want me to fess up where I come out on that?
Yeah.
I think it's all story.
Right.
And you would say, oh, God, that's terrible. It's just a story. And I would say, just a story? Just the thing that creates who we are? Just the thing that makes us human beings? To me, to say something is a story, I'll use the example. You're on a school board. Some of you, are anybody on a school board? So you have to make a choice. You have X amount of dollars, X amount of time in your kindergarten class, and the kindergarten teacher says, I've got everything planned out for the year. It's all perfect. I've either got to teach the historical fact that George Washington's false teeth were made out of wood, or the story of George Washington and the cherry tree. Now, which one's history? No, not the cherry tree. No. Which one's history? Video case. The wooden teeth, yeah? That's what's true, maybe. But which one would you vote? Oh, yeah, you got to vote for the cherry tree. That story is way more true than the wooden teeth, whether he ever cut down a cherry tree or not.
But that is very dangerous, because then you're like, well, should I teach that Columbus came over and slaughtered a ton of people, or should I teach him as a conquering, like, great victorious hero? Well, we chose to teach him as a great victorious... I mean, as soon as you decide that as a teacher, you could portray history as... or something that wasn't true from history as true.
You get on
really dangerous ground.
This is great.
Yes.
This is great.
So
what I'm arguing...
Yeah, and then history is revealed.
You're saying history
equals...
Yeah. Well, no.
No?
No.
Okay.
Perceive me.
I'm saying, you're saying like... of taking a story that didn't actually happen and teaching it as history,
I just said teach it.
But if you're telling the story of George Washington when he was little, went and da-da-da-da the cherry tree,
but you're teaching it to kindergarten.
Can you George Washington, which is a very different thing from teaching it to 12th graders.
Is it?
Oh, shoot. See, now we're at the beginning of a class, not the end of it. This is good. Okay.
I don't know.
I think that saying, you know, this is just a story, anything, especially if there's some historical evidence to back it up, actual violence. And I think there's a big difference, and I think there's a big difference as adults as to the power and the impact of the story. If there's historical evidence for it, it's much more impactful than just a story.
Yeah.
But let's take parables. If you teach the parable of the Good Samaritan, when you start teaching it to first and second graders, I want to tell you a story. There was a man who went from Jerusalem down to Jericho. When you get to junior high, you should be telling the kids, this is one of Jesus' parables. And a parable is a form of story. And in a parable, we look for the following things. Jesus never says, I'm going to tell you a parable. This isn't true, folks. This is something I made up. Don't believe it as truth or not. This is just a story. But we teach it in different ways on different levels because it says different things at different points in our maturity.
Part of the problem is that we get, whether this is what Gaia meant, she says no, but we get this messed up in our minds of history and truth and how those things relate. And that it's an interesting.
I mean, I teach poetry.
I know.
Like, screw.
No, but the other side of it too is you and probably everybody in this room, we know the power of stories. We know the power of stories. What's holding? This place exists because of the story about it. Why am I here? Not because it's, you know, got great videos of the place. I come because of the stories that I've heard about the place. And we create a story here every year. I mean, the power of stories is, we don't want to minimize that.
Out of the tomb when we're dead.
Yeah.
At some point, you have to say, no, a story can make you feel better, but there has to be a reality behind this text.
Yeah, and now you're down to
it. I personally, I'll make it my statement. Sure. I believe that there are different types of stories in this collection we call the Bible. Mm-hmm. Some are some prehistory type of mythology, but at some point, things are more historically based, but that Jesus was real.
Oh, I don't.
There are different lenses on who that person was. There are literary reconstructions, but if he was real and he was. This person I appeal to as a savior.
And I don't, I'll tell you, honestly, I don't know anybody that, I suppose there's somebody out there, but I don't know anybody who questions whether Jesus was a real person. Even non-believers, everybody believes that. The question is what his significance is. And then that's where the argument happens. Some people say he has no significance. Other people say he has ultimate significance. And that gets told what his significance is really what we're interested in. Not that he existed as a human being. How do we tell what his significance is? I think we tell that through the stories that we tell about him. Now, whether those are also historical or not, or whether they need to be historical or not, that's actually a theological debate among theologians. Does it make it, the elephant in the room, okay? Would it make a difference to Christianity if you could videotape and you knew from a scientific certainty that Jesus never rose from the grave? Many Christians would say, it makes a huge difference. Paul says, if Christ be not raised, my faith is in vain. Paul would say, yeah, it makes a huge difference. There are Christian theologians today who say, wouldn't make any difference. It's a conversation among Christians. I know where you're at on it. Some days I know where I'm at. Sometimes it's different the next day. So I go back and forth on it. But so that, I mean, that's really where it gets.
Yeah,
that is a good point. But I've lost where I'm at here.
I'm thinking about Santa Claus and how in our beginning understanding of, you know, well, as a parent, before I had children, I said, I'm not going to tell my children.
No, but you told them, didn't you?
Right?
So you lied to your kids.
So, no, I did my very best not to lie. I kind of skirted the issue. I let the culture tell this. And I think when they asked, is there a Santa Claus, they'd say, isn't that a really nice story? And really talk about the... So maybe as we grow in our faith, we continue to ask the more difficult questions and more is disclosed to us.
Yeah, exactly.
In our understanding of the issue. And that's what I do with my kids about, you know, any...
Yeah, and what I argue with students all the time is I get college students and they come in and they say, but I was taught X, Y in Sunday school. And I say, That was perfect. When you were eight years old, that was what you should have been hearing. The problem, I think, with students and is that most of us, where do we stop our thinking?
Right.
Our religious thinking, not in every other area of our life. We keep growing throughout our life. But our religion, we think, oh, that stopped with confirmation. And then that's the end of it. And that's why I love places like this, is because you all, one way or another, are kind of pushing yourselves further along. And we've got to do that so that our religious maturity matches our chronological and intellectual maturity.
Can we get back to the question of bonds?
Yeah.
In your first session, you told that very poignant story of your friend and your conversation tonight. And I asked you, if it's not Christianity, then what's his narrative? You know, where's he relying on? What's his religion?
And I said, he doesn't.
Yeah, but then you made it an even more interesting statement, I think, that was something to the effect of, and that's why I am still sticking with this, because I see what torment he's in.
Yeah.
And when I heard that, I thought, well, it's almost like you're answering from a negative instead from a positive. It's like you witness that, you see his torment, so then you're saying, well, I can't live there, so I'm going here. And I wonder if these last 4 days we've been talking a lot around. I'm going to try to tie these things together as best as I can.
Okay.
But I guess what one of the concerns I've had is it doesn't seem like we've talked a lot about paradox and the reality of making a positive statement, whether it's Christianity saying this is the light and this is the dark, this is the good and the bad. I understand from postmodern thought, mostly Michel Foucault, who would just beat it into the ground and say, anytime you make a truth statement or a positive statement, it automatically implies a power grab, and that then leads inherently to violence. But that, I think, postmodernity, seems to me, is already been tested and is being found wanting. And I think the reason it's found wanting is for the same reason your friend, that relationship with your friend. Once you continue to take apart every positive, because it could have the potential for violence, as every positive clearly does, Christianity being a prime example.
Yeah.
Once we've deconstructed everything, we have nothing left. There's no meaning. And I think one of the examples I would lift up is Christianity. And a dear friend of mine from Nigeria, who was a graduate student at my seminary, and I asked him one day, from my upper middle class, secular, progressive kind of lens, even though I was in seminary, I was sort of raised in a secular, progressive college and all those things. I said, do you actually believe it was a good thing that when the Christian missionaries came to you, that they were actually trying to spread the gospel? They were part of these companies, and they were part of a military thing, and they wanted to take over your country. And Peter Bartimaeus, this graduate student, said, but they didn't know that the gospel was underneath all of their machinations. And that the gospel, they brought education with them, they brought the gospel, and that's what then led to the liberation movement in Nigeria. So he had a very different sense of it. And to me, that brings up this idea of paradox. And I think also brings us back to this idea of what God does. Because if we're in relationship with God, and that's one of the sort of themes that I use to understand the scriptures, is to say, if we're in a loving relationship with God, then there has to be free will. There has to be give and take. And that, to me, opens up this whole category of paradox. And I can't live in a world with no meaning, and we don't. The reality is that we just don't. And to pretend that we can control all those positives, I just think is a fool's game, and I think it's been proven.
Yeah, and I think, this is what, I'm glad you brought me back. I mean, on my notes, I came back to that first question also. And that's the issue, is underlying all the violence and all the responses to it. We're Lutherans, right? Most of us. Is God under all that, holding all that up? And the answer is either, if he's not, we're screwed. Yeah? And if he is, we're going to be okay, as messy as it gets. The things that I'm evangelical about on this topic is, we can't really understand grace properly if we don't talk about violence and name it. And we you're not, I know you, probably nobody's in here disagreeing. We got to, we, if we let violence be the only people who talk about violence are the guys who make video games, who make violence fun and sexy and no stink and guts to it. We're not doing what we need to do as Christians. We have to take violence really seriously. And I think what I object to is when we don't carry out our responsibility to talk about it as bluntly as we possibly can. I've not been in a war, but when I think people who have been in wars ought to talk about what that is. Because if we don't talk really what the violence of a war is, then it's easy to convince people, oh yeah, we'll go in, we'll drop bombs from 50,000 feet. Nobody really gets hurt, right? You don't see anybody getting hurt. It doesn't stink. There's not any moral ambiguity to it. You just bomb and in 30 days we win, right? That we need to have people that really talk about the crap, literally the crap of violence. And, you know, in some ways, people, some people thought the Passion of the Christ was too gory. It wasn't anywhere near gory enough. That's the crime of that book. It made it palatable. It made it something you could go sit and eat popcorn while you're watching. That isn't what real violence is in real people's lives. And so I think as Christians, we walk away from our responsibility, especially those of us who are against it, but because we don't talk enough about it and we don't talk bluntly enough about it. We've got to say, I come back to this phrase of Luther, we have to call things by their proper name. We cannot talk, pretend like violence is some sort of small thing. And it's in all of our lives, and we have to talk about it, the impact.
I was in Durham for a Bible study 2 months on Hebrew terms, and I was working on the word tzedek, which is righteousness. And I was giving my tutor all of the understandings of righteousness, and he stopped me in the middle and said, what's the biggest sin in the Old Testament? He stopped me right in my tracks. He said, it's not sex, which we tend to think it is. The greatest sin in the Old Testament, he said, is violence.
And they knew what it meant. And they knew what it meant. Somebody else had any.
It would seem to me then that we need to be firmly intolerant of violence as entertainment.
Firmly what?
Intolerant, she said. Firmly intolerant of violence as entertainment. I mean, I think, I have to say, I watched The Longest Day, or Saving Private Ryan there. That's a good, I thought that was a great movie. Is there violence in it? Yeah. Is it entertainment? Yeah, it is entertainment, I guess. And somebody made a pile of money off of that.
But it doesn't, I didn't see the movie because I couldn't get past the first 5 minutes. But I'm not saying that there ought not to be violence in what we read and watch. Only that it ought not to, the violence itself, we ought to...
we shouldn't trivialize it.
Right. We ought to see it as awful as it is. And not laugh it off.
Yeah.
And not ignore it or disregard it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I like... What? That sounds so stupid. One thing about that movie was, when I saw that, that was the first time that I'd seen on a movie screen something like what real war must be like.
There's nothing titillating about it.
No, no.
Right, exactly.
I mean, there's that scene where the guy is running on the beach with his arm in his other hand. If you know which scene I'm talking about, that thing is burned in my mind. I will never forget that scene in my life. There are other scenes in there, to the extent that it burns that stuff in my mind, but I always have to remind myself, even that isn't it. It's way worse than that. So I think you're right. We have to speak up. I don't know that we can. We don't stop. Well, that's a good question. Should we as Christians try and stop video game industry or something like that? That now we get down to some interesting questions. You know, about the role of Christians in church and politics, sort of things.
I like what you're saying about, you know, that we need to face live in become more comfortable in a conversation about violence and even a life of violence. I think that that's when the gospel had teeth under, not under, but alongside King and Gandhi, who I consider as very Christian. I mean, Gandhi said that Jesus Christ was nonviolence par excellence. He was about this close to being baptized in South Africa. In the beginning of Gandhi's movement, he insisted that all of his followers be trained in the military, because it was only through that kind of rigorous discipline and willingness and physical ability to withstand killing and violence that you could truly love your enemy. And if people remember King, how when he was challenging Bull Connor, saying, you bring the dogs at us and we'll love you. You bring the cannon, the water cannons at us, and we'll continue to love you. You shoot us and burn us, and we'll continue to love you. You know, that's where I think, since we live we all live in our gated communities by nature of our class and our privilege. I'm thinking about Sister April bringing up Shaniqua, you know, this African-American young mother with her children living in a world where violence is much more the everyday language. I think we have to be willing to go to those dark places that we're not, you know, we're not called to. We're only called there by nature of the gospel. Bonhoeffer would say, you know, the cross bids you come and die. I don't think a lot of us really believe the gospel enough to come to a place to die.
Let me throw out one other kind of hand grenade before we got 2 minutes here. Before I run away. there's another thing here. As I look through this stuff, it seems to me to make a difference what the position of the person using the violent language is. If I think it makes a difference if I'm someone who's being oppressed and I use violent language against my oppressor, or if I'm the oppressor using violent language against the person beneath me. In other words, the connection between violence and power, I think, might be a crucial distinction. Christianity, I'll pick on my Jewish friends for a bit. Jewish people talk about using the book of Joshua as justification, about going into the land and taking over the land and killing off everybody in there. They use that model. If you go to Israel, talk to people, that's at least some of the model that they use. That might have been okay to talk that way until they get overwhelming political power. And then what happens? Then they start enacting that. And I think there's a difference between those two situations. To me, as I look at hope, I look at some of these Old Testament prophets, and they rail violently against Assyria. Anybody die because of what they said? No. But what did it do? Because of that violent language, it gave them and their people hope against that, because they believed God would destroy that enemy of theirs. When they get on top sometime, maybe today, I think the language, you can't play the same use the same language, I think. So that's a whole other set of topics that we haven't really talked about, but I want to throw out there as something that I think is an important distinction.
But how can we use that language, even from the underside, and still say, follow Jesus who says, love your enemies?
Yeah, and there's a whole another set of days of talk. He says, love your enemies, but he does other things. He does things that seem, at least, we don't talk about, you know, he talks about parables, about throwing some guy out and letting him fry forever, and letting him, you know, gnash his teeth. He uses really violent images sometimes. We don't usually tend to lift those up. We avoid them, but they're there. And I think what we do is dumb down or simplify our message so much. What we have to do is say, yeah, that's really uncomfortable. How do I do that? And that begins the conversation then. I don't think there's some magic solution. You know, just love your enemies. Jeez, that sounds nice. It's way more complicated than that, I think. And that's why I think it's good that those kind of complicated sayings are in the Bible. Because what they do is say, whoa, I better stop and think about that a little bit more.
He says love your enemies, but he doesn't say be kind to your enemies or talk nicely to your enemies.
Yeah.
Make your enemies your friends.
Yeah, but I mean, it'd be interesting. You know, would Jesus be a violent? Would he pick up an M16 and blow away an oppressor's brains to save, you know, somebody? Would you know? There's Moses, or there's Moses, you know, watching the Egyptian beat a Hebrew, and Moses kills him. Would Jesus say, "Right on, brother"?
What,
but I don't know. What would he?
Why can't we go back to the analogy of King? I mean, you couldn't dispute that when King was in front of the microphones, when all the information was there for the, you know, SCLC and SNCC, they knew that when they went to this march, there was going to be violence, and they knew that if they marched, there was going to be violence. And Gandhi knew the same thing with his nonviolent actions. So it's not so much that that Jesus is not talking. I mean, there's one thing in painting Jesus as this utter and complete pacifist in the sort of way of passivity. But you can go there with Jesus and not be physically violent and still be an advocate for justice.
But
and put your body in the way, you know, and get into the trenches.
But I think it's important to remember, too, before, like, but King and Gandhi also had really crappy relationships with their wives. Like, and no, I'm serious. And, like, you know, there's a lot of evidence about Gandhi being a real jerk to his wife. And so before we, like, lift them on a pedestal, sometimes it's easy to talk about violence as, like, the big war and wars and that kind of violence, like, what kind of violence do we participate in every day in our homes and in the relationships?
You could say the same about Dorothy Day. It seems to be an equal opportunity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm not blasting guys. I'm just saying, before we hold them up as perfect examples of...
I'm not doing that, but I don't think Jesus was perfect either. I think that's been demonstrated by our conversation. But I don't think that's I think that's missing the point.
Yeah. All right, folks, I want to respect the time. Will you continue this conversation next week, please? That would be good. I would like it if you continued it after I'm on the bus this afternoon.